Hey everyone, Adam D. from Indefensive Ska here. A little note before we start the show. Los Angeles is dealing with multiple catastrophic fires. A lot of people have lost their homes and are in need. If you're able to help, please do so. There are a lot of great organizations you can donate to, like California Fire Foundation, Pasadena Humane Society, Mutual Aid LA, and there's even a list of people in the music industry that have lost their homes. Links are in the show notes for our Rob Harvilla episode. Thanks. Consequence Podcast Network. This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host Adam D. of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in an expanded second edition.
Hey Adam, have you heard of an artist called Bob Marley?
Yes, I think I have.
Yeah, I think you and everyone else on the planet knows who Bob Marley is.
Kind of famous.
Yeah. Do you remember... So back when we were teenagers and young adults in the 90s, I feel like Bob Marley's presence like loomed over culture, like alt culture. It just whatever you go into any sort of rock and roll store or anything like that, and there's Bob Marley posters everywhere.
Yep, definitely the type of places we were hanging out. You know, skateboarders, hacky sacks, bongs. Bob Marley was everywhere.
And as a ska fan, I really enjoyed hearing his early ska work, and I just love to show it to people, you know, and blow their minds and be like, yeah, Bob Marley played ska too.
Yep.
So at this point, now we're in 2025, and I feel like Bob Marley looms over culture in a way that even exceeds how it was in the 90s.
Yeah, definitely.
There's last year there was the film One Love, which was a pretty major film and did really well. There's been tons of more books and documentaries.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm really curious to kind of like look at the state of Bob Marley and his legacy as it exists now. But first, though, let's discuss his history a little bit. He was born in 1945 in a small town in Jamaica. He began recording music in 1962, and he formed the Wailing Wailers with Bunny Wailer and Peter Tosh in 1963. They scored a number one hit on the island in 1964 with the ska song Simmer Down. But Bob Marley is much better known for his work in the 70s playing reggae. In the 70s, he worked with Chris Blackwell of Island Records. And the plan was to market Bob Marley more in the vein of a rock artist to reach a larger audience. And though he continued to grow his audience and release several amazing, critically revered records, he died in 1981 from melanoma and didn't reach quite the level of audience he would come to have after his death.
So while we no longer have Bob Marley with us, who are we going to bring on today to talk about his legacy?
Okay, we have a great guest to talk about Bob Marley, and that is Roger Steffens, who is one of the leading authorities on Bob Marley, for sure. I mean, he's written a ton of books. He toured with Bob Marley at one point in the late 70s. His book, So Much Things to Say, in 2017, is arguably the definitive oral history on Bob Marley.
Well, let's bring on Roger and talk about Bob Marley.
My name is Roger Steffens. I am a 52-year collector of all things reggae. It began with an article in Rolling Stone in 1973 by a gonzo journalist in Australia named Michael Thomas. And he said, reggae music crawls into your bloodstream like some vampire amoeba from the psychic rapids of Upper Niger consciousness. And I said, I got to find this right now. I was living in Berkeley on Channing Way, And there was a record store, a used record store down on Shattuck Avenue, and I found a copy of Catch a Fire that opened like a Zippo lighter for 2¼, and I figured I could take a chance on that. And man, it just blew my mind. And I've always been a public speaker, and whenever a subject interests me, I'll keep a file on it because someday I might write about it or lecture about it. And especially when I find something that really thrills me, like Catch a Fire did, and the following evening seeing The Harder They Come in that little theater on the north side of the Berkeley campus. And when the spliff scene came on, everybody in the theater lit a joint. And there was so much smoke you couldn't see the screen. And I bought the soundtrack on the way home. And since that day, those 2 days, everything I've encountered that has to do with reggae, Rasta, Jamaica, Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, I've saved. And they now fill 7 rooms, floor to ceiling, and about 6,000 of the most precious things were on display at the Queen Mary back in 2001 for 8 months. And that's been in storage ever since. So, the bulk of the treasures I haven't even had access to for 24 years now. But all that's about to change because my collection has been bought by a man named Joe Bogdanovich. Mm-hmm. He's the cousin of Peter, the film director. And their grandfather founded Starkist Tuna. And when he died, he left each of his grandkids for $500 million. And Joe moved to Jamaica, bought the Sting Festival and cleaned it up, bought the Sumfest Festival, which he still runs to this day. And when he heard my archive was still available, he told me back in 2018 that he would buy it. And we've been working on that plan ever since. He's going to build a museum in Montego Bay to house everything, and I'll awesome. Be the curator emeritus of it. This is probably among the last days that you will see the archives.
The archives, yeah. How many books about Bob Marley have you written at this point?
8.
8 books.
Yeah, but the latest is only in French. Mm-hmm. It's a history of the Danny Sims, Johnny Nash period from 67 to 72 that my writing partner, Leroy Pearson, and I did with Bruno Bloom, an extraordinary man in France who found us a label to collect all of the Danny Sims material, which had never been formally put together before. And that was a 6-year project that ended up with a 15-disc series called The Complete Wailers, 1967 to 1972. And the other one, this is the second most recent one. It's called So Much Things to Say, The Oral History of Bob Marley. And it's the summation of my life's work. It took 37 years of research and 15 years of writing, because of a major computer crash that took the original manuscript and all the transcriptions of 110 interviews I'd done with people who knew Bob. So I had to start all over again. But when it came out, Rolling Stone said it was a landmark and it was definitive. And they headlined the review, "This might be the best Bob Marley book ever." And there's 500 Bob Marley books.
I was going to say, having the best Bob Marley book says something, because there's quite a bit out there. Yeah. Today, I want to talk a bit about kind of where his legacy stands now. But to do that, I want to start by talking about One Love, the recent film. But I don't want to focus exclusively on this film, but I'm going to start there.
Sure.
Before we dive into like something super serious in the film, I'm curious what you thought of the one singular ska era scene of the film, where they are in at Studio One with Cox and Dodd, and they're playing It Hurts to Be Alone. Mastery breaks your heart. which is a slow R&B ballad, and then he's not impressed, and then they switch it up and play Simmer Down, and everyone's so excited. I mean, for me, I'm curious your thoughts on that scene. For me personally, I mean, it was fun. It was really fun to watch them play Simmer Down because that's such an amazing song, but I just feel like this scene is not pulled from history at all.
Well, also the fact that he's there with, you know, when they come to the audition originally and he's there with a gun and he's,
that
his family is suing the producers of the film because of that scene, Coxon's family.
So Coxon wasn't known for carrying around a gun, right?
He did have a gun. And in fact, Joe Higgs had a huge hit for Coxon with There's a Reward for Me. Mm-hmm. And when he went to get, it was number one for several weeks in a row. And after that, he went to Coxon for some royalties. And Coxon opened his desk drawer and pulled out a pistol and smashed him in the face and almost blinded him. And he was in the hospital for weeks. So the idea of Coxon having a gun is not implausible. But it was Leslie Kong who had the gun and used to shoot through the floor of the studio above his liquor store when he heard something on the microphone that he didn't like. That's how he maintained control and freaked the heck out of a lot of people. Look at the movie as a music video. Mm-hmm. Do not look at this movie for facts at all. They took such tremendous liberties in so many ways. But the good part of it is it introduced Bob to a whole new generation of people. And for that reason alone, I applaud it. But if you want to see the truth of that absolute pristine era in Bob's life, from the assassination attempt in December of 76 to the peace concert in April of 78, there's a marvelous documentary on Netflix called Who Shot the Sheriff? And I'm in it, and a whole lot of the biographers of Bob Marley are in it. And most of all, they got Edward Seaga, just before he died, to almost admit that he knew the whole thing was going to come down. I think he was trying to set history straight before he passed away. And that's an incredibly valuable service that the documentarians made by getting him to speak to them. And, you know, he said basically he always had one or two people separating him from whatever activities went on, so they couldn't trace things back to him. And that's pretty condemnatory, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was one of his chief hitmen who came to kill Bob. It was Jim Brown who led the posse.
Yeah, I've seen that film too. It's an excellent documentary. Now, I know you've already said you've made peace with the film for what it is, but I'm curious if you felt like when you first watched it there was any inaccuracies that really bothered you the most.
We don't have enough time, Aaron. I'm sorry. Well, all right, the biggest inaccuracy.
Okay.
And the most harmful was the exclusion of Cindy Breakspear, Damian Marley's mother, who at the time in 77 was Miss World. And she nursed Bob when the cancer was discovered. They were living together in London. Bob was in exile from the shooting. And she was the major figure in his life. And if you talk to the Wailers who are still alive, they'll tell you that that's the truth. And she was devastated by her exclusion from the film. They even shot some scenes with an actress playing her, but they were cut from the final cut of the movie. Yeah. Yeah, that bothered me and bothered her.
The other thing was interesting is that he did attempt to treat his cancer, and I think that was not really demonstrated in the film either. It's just, you know, he just didn't get it, you know?
Yeah.
But they kind of make it seem like, and even the narrative I've kind of heard a lot, even before this film, was almost like he wouldn't treat it.
No, he had a piece of the big toe where the cancer was removed, and they took some skin from, I think, his right thigh and put it over that, and he had to wear a special kind of boot for months and months after that. And Cindy was feeding him liver to beef him up. you know, Rastas don't eat meat, but, you know, he went so far as to disobey the Rasta tenet and was trying to make himself strong enough to fight the cancer. But, you know, he predicted his own death. Have either of you read my book?
Not yet. It's on my list, though.
Dr. Issels kept him alive for a long time. But Bob knew he was going to die at 36. He was living with his mother in that Woodstock summer of 1968 in Wilmington, Delaware. And he had two young friends, Ibis Pitts and Dion Wilson. And they were talking to him one day, and he said, they said, you know, you're going to be a big star. You're going to have lots of kids, and everybody in the world's going to know you, and you're going to have a nice long life and everything. And Bob just shook his head, and he said, no, man. He says, when I'm 36, I'm going to die. And they were so shaken by that that they went and told his mother. And I have his mother on my old cable television show telling me that they came to her that day and told her what Bob said. And she was as taken aback as they were and never forgot it. And I also interviewed Dion and Ibis, and they both told me that exact same story. Mm. I swear it's true. So I've got three witnesses to that prophecy. Bob was psychic. Bob was a prophet. Bob could see you, and within 5 minutes, he could tell you your life story. I talked to several people that he did that with.
Wow. Do you follow, like, the film, like, accuracies aside, do you think, like, they captured his vibe or his essence well in the film?
Bob was not a smiley person. Mm-hmm. Ben Adir was smiling in almost every scene of the movie. I have a well-known picture. It's adapted on the cover here. You see Bob smiling. I took that during the 2 weeks I was with Bob in 1979 in November on the Survival Tour, his last tour of California. And it was in the San Diego Sports Arena dressing room. He had a press conference. And during that hour-long press conference, it was the only time he smiled. And every camera in the place went off at once.
So was your impression of him that he was a serious man that was in deep thought frequently?
Constantly. He was a deep thinker. And he had a couple of women in his life who were responsible. And I do lengthy interviews with him in the book. Esther Anderson, the Jamaican actress, fascinating woman. And another woman who's little known, Dr. Gail McGarity. And she had tremendous contacts in Britain and in America in the intellectual black community. And Gail McGarity came into his life in the early 70s as Bob was coming to international prominence through his Island Records. And she said, people are going to look to you for the truth, and you have to know what conditions have produced this current situation that the black race is in. And she gave him books to read. She introduced him to black leaders, especially in England. And Esther Anderson was the same way. Esther Anderson made a movie with Sidney Poitier called Warm December. I think that was around the early 60s. And Esther Anderson lived with Chris Blackwell for 7 years. She was a co-founder of Island Records, gave him money to start the label in the early 60s in England. And then, no, wait a minute, I've got it backwards. Esther Anderson lived with Marlon Brando for 7 years. And then she took up with Chris Blackwell for 3 years. And then she took up with Bob Marley. And she was, she told me she wrote I Shot the Sheriff. And it's about birth, and it's about birth control. Oh, okay. How does that work, Esther? And Esther, she's a charming woman. And she's the fastest talking human being I have ever met in my life. And this is what she told me. She said, Well, Bob was very proud of his powers of impregnation, and I'd been going with Bob for a month, and I hadn't got pregnant. He wanted to know why, and I said, well, Bob, I'm not going to get pregnant. I'm on the pill, and he got very upset, and that's where the lines, every day I plant the seed, but you kill it before it grows, come from, and the sheriff is the doctor. I don't know. I wasn't there. It does make a kind of sense, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. But who's the deputy?
Yeah. Yeah, well, the doctor. Yeah. Well, if the doctor was the sheriff, who was it? The deputy.
Be the nurse, then.
The nurses, yeah. Yeah. So with this movie coming out last year, with your book coming out recently as well, have you seen a rise in interest in Bob Marley's music with audiences? Or is it all, because it seems like it's been, for most of my adult life, it just seems like Bob Marley is hugely popular. But have you seen the popularity grow even more?
Absolutely. Recently, I've got some brand new figures here. The movie really helped. It opened at number one at the American box office. And it grossed $185 million worldwide.
Wow.
That's before it began to stream. Bob Marley Facebook page draws over 66 million fans, ranking it among the top 50 of all Facebook pages and the top 20 among celebrity pages. Legend is the longest charting album in Billboard magazine's catalog album chart, and remains the world's best-selling reggae album. So far, 18 million official copies have been sold. You could probably triple that with the bootlegs. Bob was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys. And this year, he beat his Offspring for the best reggae album of the year.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. The soundtrack to One Love. Every year he breaks some new record. His songs are the soundtrack to the lives of radicals, revolutionaries, freedom fighters all over the world. A few years ago, I was interviewed by Phil Kogan, who does The Amazing Race. And he said he'd been to 130 countries. And he said, in every single place, no matter how remote, he found evidence of Bob Marley. Every one of them. And he wanted to know why. Bob is the most important musical figure of the 20th century, whose work is going to last longer than the Beatles, and, you know, U2, the Rolling Stones, Dylan. How do you translate Subterranean Homesick Blues into Urdu? But it's easy to put No Woman, No Cry into Urdu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when he asked you why that was, what was your thought? I mean, aside from his appeal, is it just the fact that he made such an effort in his life to get his music into Africa and other places?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he really wanted to move to Africa. He was terribly upset when he went to Ethiopia in 1978 because you could be put in jail, sometimes even killed, if they found you with a picture of His Majesty. So he gave up his idea of moving to Ethiopia at that point. But he did want to move there. I think I sent you a picture of me interviewing him in Selassieville, in the town that I wish he could have lived to create for repatriating Rastafari. Yeah, I did an interview in the alternate universe where he didn't die. In 2010, when he would have turned 65. And was that, let's see, because he just turned 80. Yeah, 2010, he would have been 65. So we talked to him about singing at Obama's first inauguration with Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul and the King of Reggae doing duets. And, you know, all the things we wish he could have lived to do, meet Mandela on his way out of prison and singing his Free Mandela anthem, which he surely would have written had he lived. You know, we lost so much when he died at 36.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
in Bob Marley's life, he died in 1981, I believe, right?
Yeah.
What was sort of his place in culture at the time of his death? Was he's not like he is, he was not like how he is now, right? I mean, his audience wasn't close to like the level it is now.
But don't forget, in 1980, on his last tour, he drew 110 million people to San Siro Stadium in Milan.
So it was beginning.
And the Pope had appeared there the week before, and he outdrew the Pope in Italy.
But a few years earlier, in the 70s, he was still finding his audience, would you say?
Yeah, he was building and building and building. More than anything, he wanted to reach the African-American audience. Mm-hmm. And they were impervious to him in the 70s. They didn't want to move to Africa. They wanted to move to a split level in the suburbs. And Bob was so anti-bling. I mean, he literally wore on stage what he was wearing that afternoon when he was hanging out with friends. He looked like he just stepped off some construction line in an automobile factory. He didn't do any glam. Bob was a man of the people, and he dressed that way. And in the 70s, it was Sly Stone and fur coats and jewelry and all that stuff. So Bob's audience was not a black audience. So he was going to do a tour that fall of 1980. With Stevie Wonder. He only did 5 shows before he collapsed in Central Park at the end of September of 1980. But he and Stevie Wonder were going to do shows in big stadiums or places that had fields so he could play soccer in the afternoon after the sound check. And Stevie was going to deliver a black audience to Bob Marley. And they were really looking forward to that. And Stevie had that hit Master Blaster about Bob at that same time. Tonight there will be a party on the corner at the end of the block. Didn't know you would be jamming them to the quick of now. Didn't nobody ever told you that you would be jamming them to the quick of now. That might have been a breakthrough year for Bob for the black audience. And he never lived to see that, sadly.
His audience in the 70s was mostly like hippies.
Yeah, college-educated people, radicals.
Yeah, and some of that was intentional on Chris Blackwell's part, right? In terms of how he saw the marketing of Catch a Fire and some of the subsequent releases was to sort of market it the same way he would market like a rock and roll album, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely right. And he made. Could You Be Loved with a black audience in mind. He wanted a disco-sounding song that could get black airplay. And they still wouldn't play it, so Danny Sims, who owned Jad Records, and ran Bob's career for 5 years from 67 to 72, came back into Bob's life at that time at the end of 79. And Chris gave him $80,000 to buy airplay on black radio stations. He had to buy airplay, which is why Stevie Wonder stopped making records, because they wanted him to pay to play his music on their stations. And he said, screw you, I'm not paying you to play Stevie Wonder music. And we lost a lot of music in the process. Mm.
Now, as I understand it, and I would love your take, and probably a lot better nuance than my version is, I've always understood it as Legend was released in like 84, I believe.
Right.
You already mentioned it as the number one reggae album of all times. It's my understanding is this is where Bob starts to become a bigger, more iconic celebrity, is the release of Legend.
The way I hear it from kids who were going to college in the 80s, if you entered the dorm in your freshman year and you told people you'd never heard of Bob Marley, most of the kids down the hall would be bringing their copy of Legend to you and by the end of the week, you'd be a new Bob Marley fan. And it was his, that album has, of course, they're great songs. They're Bob songs, but they're the easy listening Bob songs. Chris eventually put together an album called Rebel Music that were his politically oriented songs, the stuff that was on Natty Dread, Bob's first solo album in 74, which is one of his finest records and most in your face. That's when it was still the eye for the eye, Bob. You know, feel like bombing a church now that I know the preacher is lying. And then he got shot and he turned and he realized that, you know, eye for an eye leaves everybody blind and doesn't get you anywhere. And it became the One Love philosophy. So the most important album of his life, critically these days, is Survival, which is the statement of his mature philosophy.
How would you define the statement of survival?
Africa Unite. The idea that the unification of Africa is crucially important to the future of the whole world. And it's got to be done through the principles of one love and just open your heart to the world and heal it. The prime idea is that music can't change the world, but music can change a person, and persons change the world.
So the idea of Africa Unite, we're talking about the African diaspora, right? Africans all over the world, whether they live in Africa or not.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But pointed toward Africa, he saw too much dissension and civil war in Africa, and it hurt him, made him very sad. And that's why he loved Selassie. Selassie started the Organization of African Unity.
So between the release of Legend and the release of One Love, was there any other moments in your perspective where we saw more rises in Bob Marley's popularity, or was it sort of just an incremental?
Well, it constantly grew and grows, but I think the millennium gave us time to look back at the century's major figures. And Time magazine, thanks to Christopher John Farley, who persuaded the editors that Exodus was the greatest album of the 20th century, that helped put Bob Marley into a broader public awareness and context. And the fact that something as straight as conservative Time magazine recognized the value of Bob Marley's work in the 20th century, that was an important moment. And that brought many new people to Bob.
What about the popularity of reggae music? Is the popularity of reggae music rising alongside the popularity of Bob Marley?
Nah, reggae's dead. Dancehall killed reggae.
So what was reggae's peak, in your opinion, in terms of popularity?
Mid-80s.
Mid-80s?
Yeah. Black Uhuru, Gregory Isaacs, Dennis Brown, Burning Spear, Culture, all making great music. And finally getting enough stations, mostly college, in America, all across the country, to play that music. And I think in maybe 83 to about 87, Los Angeles was the biggest reggae city on earth. Mm-hmm. We didn't go more than a week without having one, sometimes two or three name artists from Jamaica performing here in Los Angeles. We had three reggae clubs. I was doing the Reggae Beat show at that time, and we had almost every major name in the music on the show, and we were on commercial free 4 hours every Sunday afternoon. And very often the artists would perform live in our studios, and we had so many special moments. It was a combination of a graduate seminar and Rastafarian service, groundation. Every Sunday afternoon, my partner Hank Holmes had about 8,000 Jamaican records, really knew the history. I've been on the radio since 1961. My first guest back in 61 on a commercial station, WVOX in New York, was Olatunji, the Nigerian drummer, you know, Babatunde Olatunji, yeah. Drums of Passion. So I've always been into ethnic music, African music, since probably 1959, Miriam Makeba, people like that. I'm the guy who turned Paul Simon on to Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
Oh, really?
For the Graceland album. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. This is a side tangent, but I'm going to go here. I heard a rumor, an unconfirmed rumor, that before Paul Simon made Graceland, that he was flirting with the idea of doing a Scottalites-like ska record. Do you know anything about this? Never heard about it?
Never heard that.
Okay.
No. No. When he changed labels, you know, in 83, when he went to Universal, after all those years on Columbia, the president of the label called me up, because I was doing an African music show at the time, too, with Tom Schnabel, called Morning Goes Makossa. And he said he had just signed Paul Simon, and Paul was interested in doing something in Africa, and could I send him some of the music that I thought he should listen to? And one of our listeners was a South African film director who lived at Venice Beach, and he was going home for a while, and he said, give me some money and I'll bring you back some records. And he brought me back several records, including a beautiful Ladysmith Black Mambazo album with all 12 members in a tree. And Joseph Shabalala, the lead singer, at the base of the tree. And that's the album that I sent to Paul, along with a copy of Rhythm of Resistance, which is just an amazing album of South African music. And he fell in love with Ladysmith, and 2 years later he went to South Africa and found him for the record.
Bob Marley. So there's a few figures in the 20th, 21st century that I feel like have sort of ascended rock star status to like an almost deity status. You know, I feel like Jerry Garcia, John Lennon, you know, some of these people, but Bob Marley is definitely one of those people where I feel like almost gets viewed like not like almost like he's not even a human. Like he's this kind of like godlike figure.
Well, the one closest to that and sainthood is Bob Marley.
So what is your opinion on it? Does that like you had spent time with him when he was still alive. Do you feel like this is a good representation of him, or does it feel like we're taking him out of context?
Let's take one fact for an example. They say he made about $30 million while he was alive. He gave away almost all that money. Mm-hmm. He didn't even have a real bed until about 18 months before he died. He slept on a cot in the attic of Tuff Gong until some women in his life got together and bought him a real bed. He had lines from the front door of Tuff Gong through the yard all the way out into the street whenever he was home, from people begging him money. His business manager, Colin Leslie, is one of my dearest friends, and he had to co-sign the checks or they weren't valid. So he knows how Bob spent the money. And he told me a story once about a guy who came and he said he wanted to start a coconut oil business. And Bob wrote him a big check right away. And when he left, Colin said, why'd you do that, Bob? And Bob says, oh, Colin, I've always wanted to be in the oil business. But he would help a farmer whose tractor broke and he couldn't bring his crops in, and he'd buy him a tractor. You know, if you came in with any legitimate reason, he would write you a check. And a lot of people depended on Bob every month for a payment that would let them live in their home. These are things that go unremarked, but tell you what kind of a person Bob truly was. One of the most generous people who ever lived. He didn't live for himself. He lived for others. If he can't do something to make his people more independent, then what good is his work? He was selfless. Selfless.
In your research, was he always like this, or did he have a turning point in his life that steered him in this direction?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think once he had the money, he had to think of what to do with it. And right from the start, he was helping people. Yeah. So, I mean, he didn't think about it because he didn't have any money until probably around 75. Mm-hmm. First real money he made was writing songs for Johnny Nash when they were both on the Jad record label, Johnny, Arthur, and Danny. Incidentally, there's a movie in the works for 20 years, I've been advising, that tells the story of that five-year fecund period when Bob Marley was a Jad record artist and Danny Sims was trying to break him on Black American radio stations, but his songs sounded so odd in this time of psychedelic rock that they couldn't get any airplay for him at all in America. But Johnny covered him. Johnny covered, more than a dozen Bob Marley songs and made beautiful versions of it. In fact, his version of reggae on Broadway is much better than Bob's. I wanna dance. I wanna take romance. I wanna dance, baby. I wanna take romance. That was the single they released on CBS in 1972 in England when he was briefly a CBS artist. And then Danny Sims sold the contract again to Chris Blackwell, and Chris put Bob on the map.
Johnny Nash, some of his music kind of goes unnoticed, that it's either reggae or reggae-influenced.
Oh, very reggae-influenced.
But it sort of kind of fell under, it kind of just was sort of categorized as American soul music, but it was extremely like...
Right. Nobody ever used the word reggae to describe it. First time I ever heard it. I've been into music really deeply since I grew up on Alan Freed in New York City. And I had never heard the word reggae till that article in Rolling Stone in June of 73. Yeah, but Johnny was making reggae-sounding records, if you knew what reggae was in those days. And, he should be congratulated for his role in trying to break reggae in America.
I can't really think of another artist of that era, American artist of that era, that was so that was playing reggae to that degree and was getting airplay. Like he kind of stands on his own a bit in that.
Yeah, absolutely right.
But the interesting thing is, like you were saying, is like him and Bob Marley had a relationship. So Bob is part of the story of Johnny Nash and Johnny Nash.
Yeah. Oh, without question. I mean, from the Ground Nation in January of 1978, when they met him, you know, and Bob loved Johnny's music. He said he sang like a bird. And they did a tour of England together.
Oh, yeah? What year was that?
That was in 72, promoting reggae on Broadway. And it's kind of a sad story about a show they did together in the north of England in 72, where the Wailers were Johnny's opening act, and Bob had brought the band over, Fams and Carly. And they opened with Rastaman Chant. And they got the whole audience of these white kids in the north of England to chant along with them. And the end of their set, they started a conga line kind of thing through the theater. And they went out through the front door, and the audience followed them out. And then Johnny came out on stage, and a few people trickled back in, and he started singing really limp, lame soul songs. And by the third song, the theater was empty, and everybody was outside getting the Wailers to sign autographs for them. And Bunny Wailer tells the story, and he said, then we couldn't find Johnny, and we ran around to the back of the theater, and there he was punching his fist into a brick wall. And Bunny said, and he never toured again. I don't know if that's true or not. But, I talked to virtually everybody who was important in Bob's life in this book. 75 people, almost all of them Jamaicans. So this is not Timothy White making up conversations in the bedroom between Bob and Rita. This is... The people who went through these events in Bob's life with him, in the room with him, and uncensored versions of their interviews with me, 75 people. And Yeah. So if you want to know the truth about these events, but the great missing person was Johnny. I tried so many years to get him to talk to me, but he was so burned out. I think, you know, Danny was a mobster and he worked with the Gambino family. And I think that got to him. Johnny ended up quitting the music business and becoming a preacher in Houston.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He drove him out of the business. But I would have, and I got a letter from his lawyer, you know, sending his regrets. But, you know, the stories are out there. Let them rest. It's a shame. I really wanted him to counter Bunny's story about him punching his fist into the wall.
Yeah.
In frustration. And the other people that never talked, virtually never talked, are the two women from the Coxon era, from the ska era. You know, the Beverly Kelso and Cherry Green.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly Kelso lives in the Bronx. Cherry Green lived in Florida. I tried for 20 years to get them to talk to me. I wrote them letters. I called them. I begged them. I kept calling them. I kept writing them. And finally, my friends, the Midnight Ravers on WBAI in New York, got them to agree to talk to me. And they flew a Cherry up from Florida, and Beverly came down from the Bronx, and we did 9 hours of interviews with them. Cherry Green was called by Stephen Davis in his first very fine biography of Bob's, Cherry Smith, because he couldn't find out her last name, so he just made it up. So for years, people thought it was Smith. And she told me in the interview that, in fact, her name wasn't even Cherry Green. As it was with a lot of people, there were loose family bonds. So Cherry had a half brother named Green, and she was a light skinned girl. So of course, in the ghetto, they would call her Cherry. And they thought because she was the sister of this kid named Green, that she was Cherry Green, but her real name was Ermine Bramwell.
Hmm.
Ermine Bramwell. So we got interviews. They're on 30 tracks. 30 tracks, almost all of them ska tracks, and wow. They never made a dime. Coxon would give them £3 to buy a dress when they had a live stage show, and there were very few of those on which they sang. So it's a twisted history in so many ways, and what I wanted to do was put all the rumors to rest with this book, all the idea that, you know, the CIA killed Bob Marley and Carl Colby Jr. Set up the hit. You know, nobody ever interviewed Carl Colby Jr. His father had been the head of the CIA. He was part of the film crew that went down, hired by Chris Blackwell to film the Smile Jamaica concert. And he got there the night of the shooting. They were leaving the airport, and they were listening to the radio in the car as they were going to the hotel, and they heard about the assassination attempt. And nobody ever interviewed him. I found him in the Beverly Hills phone book. I called him up and invited him over to the archives, and I showed him all these magazine articles saying that, you know, he killed Bob Marley. Oh, and poor guy, he was so upset. He loved Bob Marley. Didn't care too much for his father, but he just loved Bob, you know. So the book goes into great detail, especially about Dr. Issel's and his time with Bob, because a lot of people were saying Dr. Issels was a Nazi. And that turned out to be true.
Hmm.
But it was a much more complicated story than just that fact. And this is almost Trumpian in the way that it has been used by people over the years. Dr. Issels became... Do you mind if I go off on tangents like this?
Please.
Please do.
Please go off.
Dr. Issels became a doctor in 1933 in Germany, and he went to work for a Catholic hospital. And the priest in charge of the hospital said, you know, if you want to make fast career advancements now, you should join the SS. So he did. And in 1938, the SS ordered him not to treat any more Jewish patients. And he refused. And he was conscripted into the army and sent to frontline combat in Russia, where he got captured and he spent most of World War II in a Russian prisoner of war camp. So the idea that there was somehow terrible guy treating Bob Marley and helping kill him is just utter nonsense. And Bob was given about 3 weeks to live in October of 1980 in New York at Sloan Kettering Hospital. And in desperation, he went to Issel's clinic because Issel's only took people who had been given up by their doctors, and he had a 10% cure rate. But it was a very strict regimen, and you had to live up to it, to the finest piece of it. And he kept Bob Marley alive for another 6 months, when he probably would have been dead if he had stayed in the States. And some people came from Jamaica with a bunch of food that he wasn't supposed to eat. And that reversed the course of the drugs and treatments he'd been getting from Dr. Issel's. And he died on May 11th in 1981.
Earlier, you had said that, you know, Legend was sort of the easy listening sort of collection of Bob Marley stuff. And then Rebel Music was kind of the more...
the gutsy, revolutionary.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, like, in mainstream culture, Bob Marley's popularity has grown. Do you think people understand him as the political figure he was, or do you think a lot of people think of him more as somebody who would get up and just say, "Why can't we all get along?" Because I feel sometimes there's something missing in people's understanding of reggae and Bob Marley in terms of the message.
Well, it's the marijuana.
Yeah,
it's the marijuana. They just think of Bob and pot.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, but if they spend some time really listening to his music, they're going to discover it was a whole lot more than legalizing herb. Same thing with Peter Tosh, who was so revolutionary. And people just, you know, think of his, marijuana songs. If the pot music brings people to Bob and they start a serious listening to him, they're going to hear the revolutionary stuff too. That's what's important. That's what's going to keep them alive. Now that pot is legal in so many places, it's not quite as revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah,
they fulfilled their purpose. they helped legalize marijuana. Thank God. Thank Jah.
But even the concept of One Love, I think maybe you described it earlier. I think maybe some people don't even understand what love, One Love, really means. Like, I think some people just think of it as like, let's all be nice to each other.
Yeah, let's all, you know, go to the dance and party together. No, One Love means taking care of your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
helping in every way you can to make this a better world. That's what One Love is. One Love is an action.
Yeah.
We are all equal. We are all children of Jah. So let's get together and feel all right.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying Ska now more than ever. Hey folks, once a month, our Patreon subscribers get a brand new bonus episode. These bonus episodes are completely different from our usual content. Here's a sample of the conversation we have waiting for you on our Patreon this month.
So over the life of the podcast, who continues to be like any white whales that you haven't gotten a chance to talk to yet, or maybe somebody that turned you down that you really wish they said yes?
I don't really get turned down so much as no replies. I honestly would still love to get anyone from No Doubt to come on the podcast. I've actually really been after Eric Stefani. That's kind of like, that's the member I'd really like, because he was the one that started the band. he was the one that envisioned the band, and he was pretty much the leader of the band and up until the point he quit, which was partway through Tragic Kingdom. And he was the ska guy. You know, he was all about ska. So he's a big one. Eric Andre. Why not Eric Idle? I don't know. Let's have him come on too.
To get access to this episode and all of our exclusive backer content, go sign up for our Patreon today. That's patreon.com/indefensiveska. Ska now, more than ever.